celebrity and kind of wined and dined the French. So he really was a good negotiator with them to help support the war. So at the age of 19, Lafayette decided that he wanted to follow in the footsteps of his ancestors and seek glory in the war. And the American Revolution really fit the bill. There wasn't anything for him to do at the time except for this. he was just really gung-ho. And he was really inspired by the Enlightenment thinkers. He was very impressed with the Declaration of Independence, which he had read. And of course, many of you know it draws heavily from Enlightenment ideals. He also disliked the British. The British had been in a war with the French in the Seven Years' War. It was actually a conflict between Great Britain and France during the mid-18th century when the British were taking control of French colonies, actually in North America, so over here. So kind of all of these factors came together for him, and he purchased a boat, which he named La Victoire, to cross the Atlantic, and he self-funded his trip to America. So, but prior to leaving France, he asked for and was granted the rank of Major General by the American diplomat Silas Deane, and he agreed to be not paid for his services. So he arrived in South Carolina in June 1777. So while in America, Lafayette proved himself to be a skilled military officer, earning the respect and friendship of George Washington. And Washington really became a father figure to Lafayette. Lafayette, having lost his father when he was only 2 years old, his father had died in a battle in that Seven Years' War, and another reason why he hated the British. and also Washington did not have any biological children of his own. So the two really formed a very close father-son type relationship. So Lafayette commanded American troops at several battles, including the siege of Yorktown in 1781. And actually before the war ended in 1779, Lafayette returned to France and was very useful as a diplomat for America, asking for supplies, ships, and troops for the American cause. And through his connections in the French court and assisting Ben Franklin and John Adams, who was there then as well, he helped to secure French soldiers for the war, who were then commanded by Rochambeau. So you might have known some of that about Lafayette. Some of you guys in this room I know a little bit about John Brown, but a lot of you probably don't. So the question is, why did this Revolutionary War hero go visit them, the Browns? So John Brown built Liberty Hall, as you see there, in 1796. And he was actually a contemporary of William Croghan of Locust Grove, and I know they knew each other. I don't know too much, but I know in the early 1800s, they were both members of the Indiana Canal Company that hoped to build a canal around the Falls of the Ohio, which that didn't ever come to fruition, but I'm sure they knew each other in other ways as well. And that's Margaretta there. So John Brown was born in Virginia in 1757, and incidentally, that is the same year Lafayette was born. They're actually both born in September. Lafayette is September 6th, so a couple days would be his birthday, and then Brown was born in September 12th, so they were very, very, almost exactly the same age. So Brown came to Kentucky when it was still part of Virginia, and he settled in Danville in 1783, in what was really then the West. And he was a lawyer there, and then soon got into politics and started representing the District of Kentucky in the Virginia legislature. That was from 1784 to 1788. He then went on to represent Kentucky in the U.S. House of Representatives. And when Kentucky became a state in 1792, the newly formed Kentucky legislature elected him as one of Kentucky's first U.S. senators. So he was in that position for three terms, from 1792 to 1805. And his wife, Margaretta Mason Brown, who you saw on the last slide, she was from New York City. And she and John Brown moved to Frankfort in 1801. They had two sons that lived to adulthood, Mason and Orlando. And I'm going to talk about them in a little bit here. So skipping ahead back to the 1820s, 1824, Lafayette became the nation's guest when President James Monroe and the U.S. Congress invited Lafayette to visit America. He was the last surviving major general of the Revolutionary War, and also America would be celebrating its 50th anniversary of the war in 1825. So Lafayette's visit to Liberty Hall was just one of many, 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 many stops he made on this tour. He visited all 24 states, the ones there in kind of a pinky color, pale pink, I guess, of the Union in 13 months from August 1824 to September 1825. And he was entertained at balls and banquets, praised in speeches, songs, and poems, and escorted through towns by military guards. And many towns erected kind of makeshift arches for his arrival, sort of like this one in this slide here in Philadelphia. So this tour was a really big deal, and there were a lot of mementos created commemorating Lafayette's visit. And you see here a vest with Lafayette's image all over it, a glove with his face on it. There was a ribbon there as well. And then some ceramics, a pitcher, a plate, there's a box. So making all these souvenirs was actually really good for the American craftsmen at that time as well. So after this visit is when everything got named after him. So, I know, so 17 counties, including Fayette County, 75 towns, including Lafayette, Kentucky, 9 public squares, roads, high schools, colleges, buildings, rivers, and parks. Let's see if I got them all here. The streets, yeah, it just keeps going. So some of them used Fayetteville, you know. Oops, moving ahead here. Anyway, so you get the point. So, but prior to visiting Frankfort, Lafayette had been here in Louisville. And this map is, if anybody has ever seen this website, it's the Lafayette Trail website. And a Frenchman has been putting this together, a French citizen. His name is Julien Isher. And he has, he actually visited me about a year ago, I think it was. So this is a really great resource if you ever want to know exactly where he went. So he's done Kentucky here. So as I said, he made 4 stops. We're going to look a little bit more at the Frankfort stops. So one of them was at the Public Square Green, which is the current old state capitol lawn, which this is a misleading image because at the time that Lafayette visited, that state house had burned in 1824, so it really was literally a public green. And there was a public reception held there and a dinner. And apparently there was a description of a tent in one of the newspapers made of Irish linen that resembled a small house was erected to receive Lafayette in the public green. So of course he went to Liberty Hall, and then he also visited the home of Dolly Madison's sister. Her name was Lucy Payne Washington Todd, and that's on Wapping Street, which is, that house is still there. She was married to Chief Justice Todd, who was a U.S. Supreme Court judge. And then the Weisiger Tavern, which is now the site of a bank, Whitaker Bank in Frankfort. And the tavern is where a ball was held in Lafayette's honor and where he stayed overnight. And according to the Argus of Western America, which is a Frankfort newspaper, the ballroom at Weisiger Tavern was one of the largest rooms for a ball in the Western country with a splendid area for dancing. And I have the image there is a kind of an old map. It says Tunstall's Tavern, but I believe he lived across the street and he bought that at some point. And that little tavern there became the Weisiger Tavern. So the reason we know that Lafayette visited Liberty Hall is from a letter that Margaretta Brown wrote to her stepmother, Sarah Van Alston Mason, on July 12, 1825, where she describes the visit. So the original of this letter is actually missing, but we have handwritten and typed transcripts of it at Liberty Hall in our collection, and it was also cited in Alice Trebue's 1922 book, A Corner in Celebrities. So I don't have any doubt that it actually existed, and it also really sounds like Margaretta, and having read a lot of her letters, it's definitely her. So she describes in this letter that a splendid ball was to be given in the evening. And pictured here is the invitation to the ball held at that tavern, the Weisiger Tavern. If you read the small print on this, it actually says May 9th was the date instead of May 14th. But the 9th was actually the attended date, but the general got delayed, so the invitations had already printed, so they still went ahead with these. And also, the committee is listed on there who organized the ball. And I'll get back to that a little bit later, too. So Margareta wrote that she was first introduced to Lafayette at his marquee because there were many ladies who do not attend balls and yet wish to see the general, and I was one of that number. And Margareta is referring to that outdoor reception that was on the public square green, and she writes that she had such a hearty and long-continued shake of the hand, I know, as to occasion the envy of many an impatient expectant. I know, she's really, her writing's very, very fun. So, Auguste Levasseur, and I'm just a Kentucky girl trying to say French names here, so just forgive me if I mess them up. Levasseur accompanied Lafayette on the grand tour as his secretary, and he also describes this reception on the public green. And he wrote in a published travelogue of the trip in 1829 that before the dinner, they passed several hours in receiving visits and marks of friendship from the whole population, which in Frankfurt, that would have been about 1,800 people in 1825. That's a lot. So the general then went to a dinner that had been prepared for him on that green. That was for 800 people and included a lot of militia who escorted him from Louisville, officers from Kentucky and Tennessee who had distinguished themselves in war. General Adair and Robert McAfee were in attendance. And McAfee was the lieutenant governor of Kentucky at the time, and he was also the chairman of the committee to honor Lafayette in Frankfort. He had served in War of 1812, and Adair had served in the Revolutionary War. So after meeting Lafayette at the public reception, Margareta went home, and she writes that 12 or 14 of her friends took tea with her and urged her to go to the ball. But since she had not frequented any place of public amusement for many years, she refused the invitation. She refused because she was a pretty religious person, and some of the other those friends, the 12 or 14 friends were also, but they just really wanted to meet the general. So she writes that they all paraded off to the ball except for Elizabeth Humphreys and myself. And this person that stayed behind is actually going to be the future wife of Robert Todd. It's Betsy Todd. She's Mary Todd Lincoln's stepmother. So at this time, she's unmarried. She's the daughter of John Brown's sister, Mary Brown Humphreys. So Betsy was Margareta and John's niece. And all these families, you'll see, they're all connected in some way. They're all married, or these kind of big, prominent families from Kentucky. So let's see. So then she says that her friends had not been gone more than 20 minutes when who should arrive but General Lafayette, his son, George Washington Lafayette, and the French suite Levasseur. Margareta wrote that the general spent nearly an hour with us in the most delightful conversation, while those who went to the ball did not exchange a syllable with him. I know, she's hilarious. And then she says, had I not a triumph? She really delights in this. One upmanship here, doesn't she? But from that, you know, this was definitely an unexpected visit. She didn't know that he was coming. And she does not mention her husband as being part of this conversation. Although we don't, you know, he might have been there. So there's really no evidence to suggest that John Brown was there or that he wasn't there. We just don't know. And also in that travelogue I showed you earlier, this visit is not described. I looked it up. He did leave out some things. He couldn't get everything. There were so many places they went. So the question is, did Lafayette come to see Margareta specifically, or was he there to visit John Brown as well? So for the sake of argument, we're going to look at the possibility that Lafayette came to see John Brown. After all, many have claimed that John Brown was the aide-de-camp to Lafayette during the war, and in fact, the historical marker right in front of Liberty Hall reads just that. It says that Brown was in the Revolutionary War under Washington and served as aide to Lafayette. And family lore and several written accounts have also made this claim. So we're going to look into this a little. So this seems like the source of all these accounts can be traced back to an extended obituary written by John Brown's son, Orlando, in an issue of the Frankfort Commonwealth in September of 1837. John Brown died in August of 1837. And the obituary states that John Brown united himself with the retreating army, retreating American army, crossed the Delaware with them, and remained in some time in the service without being attached to any particular corps. And then subsequently to this, he volunteered in a company which was raised in Rockbridge for the purpose of aiding Lafayette in the military operations in Virginia, with which he remained until it was disbanded by the order of the general. It does appear that John Brown may have played some sort of supporting role during the war. So Orlando's obituary, which, by the way, is extremely, when I said it was extended, that's just one of, there's like three columns like that. It's just crazy long. But there's really no evidence that he served in the regular army. There's no military record for that period, and he didn't receive any veterans land grants, although he does purchase some land that was veterans land. He did have a lot of land in Ohio, but that came much later. So there's just no definitive record of the number of men who served in the militia, the Virginia militia, during the Revolution. It was kind of continually changing. People were being drafted into the regular army or the Continental Army, so it was a number that was continually in flux. So it's kind of hard to track. But at the outbreak of the war in 1776, John Brown was attending Princeton College, then called the College of New Jersey. He was only there for about 3 months when the school closed in late November due to the war. And many students had to depart on foot, and it seems plausible that Brown and the other students did retreat with the American Army, who crossed the Delaware River at Trenton into Pennsylvania. But this is well before the Washington crossing at Christmas. Christmas night. But in early December, the American Army did cross the Delaware from New Jersey into Pennsylvania, and they actually confiscated every single boat they could get, thus preparing them for the famous recrossing on Christmas, the surprise attack of the Haitian mercenaries in Trenton. So being far away from home and being immersed in the chaos that must have been erupting with the American and British armies arriving, perhaps Brown did retreat into Pennsylvania, and perhaps he did stay there in some kind of role. It could be just what Orlando said here. And so if you look at that map, you can see where he was in Princeton. I mean, he was very close. He could have come across the river there and then just stayed in that area. Because the attack, they went back up and came back down. So, and then the next part of the obituary states that that's when he talks about him being aiding Lafayette in his military operations. And this could have been true also because he was from Rockbridge County, but I haven't found any records to prove that. It does seem like John Brown, who was 21 years old at the time, seemed kind of more concerned with school than being a soldier. And so he again goes back to school in December of 1778. This time he goes to William and Mary, which is much closer to his home in Virginia, in Williamsburg, and he finishes his law studies under both Edmund Randolph, the Attorney General of Virginia, and George Wythe, the first American law professor. But he actually finishes under quite a bit of distress as he becomes very ill in the late summer, fall of 1780. So in a letter to his uncle Preston, William Preston, in October, he writes, "I was taken with the most violent bilious fever, which left me so low in my bowels in so much a state that I have never gathered strength or been able to take more nourishment than barely sufficient to preserve life, reducing me to a mere skeleton, a condition which I scarcely expect to recover." I think this was probably malaria in the Chesapeake Bay area, which was really well known at the time to be unhealthy in the summer. It's a swampy area. It kind of still is a swampy area with a lot of mosquitoes. So not only is he sick, but he writes also about the impending invasion of the British. And he says that the town has been deserted, the college is going to be suspended. He writes he's too weak to leave, and that all the students except those one or two that are sick have turned into soldiers, and he's one of those people that's sick. He fears he may not last anymore. He had no access to food. I think he really thought he was dying at this point, and he states that everything is utmost confusion. So by January of 1781, the college does close as the British Army were then invading Virginia. And so sometime in late 1780, early 1781, he recovers from this illness, and he did find his way back home. So kind of at that same time in 1781, Washington decided to head south and strike a blow at the enemy in Virginia, and this would culminate with the siege of Yorktown. So let's see, maybe I'm not getting this right. There we go. So Washington had stressed upon the governor of Virginia, who was then Thomas Nelson, that provisions be provided, that cattle, forage, and teams of horses and wagons were needed if the Americans were to be victorious over British General Cornwallis in Virginia. Nelson asked that all the militiamen turn out and that everyone supply flour, cattle, wagons, and horses. And we know Lafayette, of course, participated in this campaign and this siege. And, you know, it's possible Brown did serve in some capacity in the Rockbridge County Militia during this campaign. It could have been logistical support, like getting supplies or food to the troops. One militia in Virginia loaded pack horses with flour and bacon for troops. It's also worth noting that there was a Virginia law in 1777 that required all free males between the ages of 16 and 50, with certain exemptions, be enrolled and formed into militia companies. So it's very likely that he served in some way and thus aided Lafayette's efforts in Virginia. And that's kind of from a very behind the scenes way and not as a soldier. What seems to have happened is that this word aid, it just turned into a noun instead of a verb. It really changed the story of Brown's military service, kind of embellishing his role. His son had just simply said he aided Lafayette, not that he was his personal aide. So as often can happen with history, especially by family members who want to believe the best of their ancestor. So it's my belief that John Brown did not personally know Lafayette, and we can rule him out as a purpose of Lafayette's visit. Unless it was simply because he was a man of political importance and he was in Frankfurt, so he visited, but I don't think that's why. And also, I noted that he was not listed as on that invitation I showed you earlier. He's not listed as a manager. Therefore, he did not help organize the ball for Lafayette. And I looked at that list, and there was a lot of very prominent Frankfurt men, including lawyers, judges, and military men. So another possibility is that Lafayette's visit had something to do with James Brown. This is John Brown's brother, who was ambassador to France from 1823 to 1829. So a little background on James. He was the younger brother of John. He was also trained as a lawyer. He was the first Secretary of State for Kentucky. But then he went to New Orleans in 1804, and he ran a very highly profitable sugar plantation. He was the secretary and then attorney for the territory of Orleans, and then he became, I think he was the first United States senator from Louisiana. He served two different terms. He's also the brother-in-law to Henry Clay. His wife is Nancy Hart, whose sister is Lucretia. So another connection, he's related to Henry Clay. So, as the minister to France, Brown actually delivered the letter to Lafayette from President Monroe, informing him by congressional resolution that he'd been invited to the United States. And Lafayette received that letter in February of 1824. And Monroe stated that Congress has passed a resolution in which the sincere attachment of the whole nation to you is expressed, whose ardent desire is once more to see you amongst them. And that Lafayette should come to his adopted country of his early youth, which has always preserved the most grateful recollection of your important services. So another interesting part of this letter, that Margaretta had, the letter from July 1825, discusses how after visiting Frankfurt, Lafayette went to Lexington. That was his next stop, and he arrived there on May 16th. She relates that the Browns' eldest son, Mason, who's pictured here, was introduced to the general in Lexington, and Lafayette told Mason that he was indebted to his family for all the honor and pleasure he had received since his arrival in America, for that if his uncle James Brown, our minister at the court of France, had not become security for his return, he would have never been permitted to leave France. So we're going to talk about what that means exactly. So at that time, there was kind of a good deal of tension between King Louis XVIII, who was pretty conservative, and Lafayette. He had returned. Lafayette, you know, he came back from the American Revolution a hero. There's a lot that happens in between there, that the French Revolution, and I'm not going to get into all of this. But by 1823, Lafayette, who's 66, that's when he came here, he was sort of at the end of his political career in France. So he had been a member of the Chamber of Deputies, which was like a parliament from 1818 to 1823. And when he was a member, he advocated for freedom of the press, personal liberty, and the right to vote for all. Lafayette did believe in a constitutional monarchy, so he didn't want to get rid of the king. He wanted to keep the king. But he also wanted an elected parliament and a constitution. And by 1820, the government in France had imposed censorship and plural voting, which is giving two votes to the wealthiest instead of one. Lafayette totally disagreed with that. And he was not reelected in 1823. So the invitation to the U.S. really came at the right time for him. He did come in 1784, but he hadn't returned since, and he didn't get to, you know, so he really wanted to come back to the U.S. to see for himself the fruit born on the Tree of Liberty. So the timing also benefited the U.S. Because Monroe, for Monroe, it was kind of a symbolic gesture to have Lafayette visit on the impending 50th anniversary, but it was also to reinforce the Monroe Doctrine, which was written in 1823. This is opposing European colonialism. So he was trying to get the European nations, these old world powers, to stay out of, try not to control the anything in the Americas. So having Lafayette there was a really great symbol of independence as he traveled throughout the U.S. So in letters to James Monroe leading up to the voyage, James Brown states that Lafayette has a lot of financial trouble and that Lafayette calls upon Brown frequently in Paris. And in a May 30th letter, Brown writes, "General Lafayette calls upon me almost every day." And although offered a free ride to America via a U.S. frigate, Lafayette had declined. He thought it was an imposition and undemocratic. So instead, Lafayette was trying to raise money for this voyage. His friends actually ended up pooling all the money for the trip so he could buy passage. And Brown had stated in one of these letters that Lafayette is working to raise money at any sacrifice. And the phrase that from the earlier slide, "not permitted to leave France," for Margareta's letter has been assumed to mean that the king wouldn't allow it. But in this context, I think it means that he didn't have the means financially to leave France. In fact, in a letter to President Monroe from James Brown, he actually uses that phrase. Brown writes about the financial affairs, and he says, "They were not such as would permit him to leave France." So once rich, he's now totally broke. His financial situation did not permit him to leave. Lafayette eventually left France on the American merchant vessel Cadmus on July 1824. And also, I think the letter implies that James Brown was held as security. People have assumed that Brown was held hostage until Lafayette returned. And there's nothing to support that notion at all, that he was a hostage of the French court. And like I said, Lafayette might have had a little tension with the king, but he was completely free to leave the country in 1824. What I think it means is that Brown helped to secure money for Lafayette for his Revolutionary War service. He writes of this in letters to Monroe. He says that this payback would help offset the expenses of the voyage. Let's see here. And having never seen the original of this letter, and we've only seen a transcript, I can only guess that this original letter was mistranscribed And perhaps instead of James Brown becoming security, it was more likely to arrange the security or the guarantee of a repayment of a loan. So Brown likely helped facilitate in some way the repayment, because before Lafayette left America, Congress did award him with $200,000 in government bonds. And they also gave him a land in Florida. So Lafayette had probably counted on getting this money for his return trip to France. However, he was so well received in America that this time he just decided to go ahead and accept a free ride on the USS Brandywine, which was commissioned in his honor for his return trip. And that was named the Brandywine because that was his first battle. That's actually the battle where he was wounded. He was shot in the leg. So it does make sense that Lafayette would have been thankful for Brown's role in making the trip happen and helping Lafayette acquire money and land for his service in America. He would definitely be indebted to the Brown family. And the tour ultimately really enabled Lafayette to regain some political prestige in France. And as he was in financial trouble, it also helped him with that. So there's been a lot of myths and embellishments regarding this visit, and we've already talked about John Brown's Revolutionary War service or lack thereof. And the letter also spawned myths that persist to this day about artifacts in our collection. And I just want to go over these because I am a curator and I like to talk about the stuff. So one such artifact is a teacup. And you know, we run up against these kind of stories all the time, and they really do seem to kind of proliferate in historic house museums. And when I started Liberty Hall, which was about 7 years ago, I used to give public tours on a very like every week. And I know I was asked this question at least once when in the dining room and in proximity to a teacup like the one here, people would say, "Is that the teacup Lafayette drank from?" So I always got that question. And the cup, which is also shown in the postcard, it actually dates to 1844, so couldn't have possibly been this cup. And furthermore, in the letter, Margareta mentioned that she took tea with her friends prior to his arrival. Then she says she spent an hour with the general in the most delightful conversation, but she never mentions that they drank tea. So Lafayette's visit and the drinking of the tea with her friends kind of got conflated. He may or may not have drank tea, but if he did, he certainly didn't do it from a cup from 1844. And the source of this myth is from a tour we have from the 1970s, and it stated that the most famous piece of china in the house was the cup that Lafayette drank from. And it comes up again in another tour from 77 that we have in our office, that it kind of identified it as this small yellow cup and saucer, and that's, you can see it also sort of in that cupboard on the second shelf in that postcard. I also think this is a cup might have been used for coffee as well. It's another little issue there. So it must have just got incorporated, this myth, into the tours, and that's why 35 years later people were still asking me about it. So we have another little artifact here that has a little association too with Lafayette, and I'm calling it the ale glass myth. So it's we got these from a donor. A Brown family descendant gave us 10 glasses in 2007. Maybe Lafayette was served a beverage. They claimed he was served a beverage from one of these glasses. So perhaps instead of tea, Lafayette had a beer or cider. So these glasses actually date for the right time period. They're 1820 and were supposedly owned by John and Margareta. So at least the date is right. So it could have actually used it, unlike the teacup. So, you know, people really like to ascribe artifacts to people. And it's kind of impossible to do sometimes, but it does make for good storytelling. So I'm going to end here and take any questions. Yes?
Could you just talk a little bit more about Liberty Hall itself?
Oh, sure, yeah. Well, we are a Georgian. Oh, the question was, she asked me to talk about Liberty Hall itself. Just the house or anything? Yeah. So it's a Georgian-style home, and it was probably one of the, you know, very impressive home in Frankfurt. Frankfurt was really small when it was built. We don't know who the architect was of it. We think John Brown might have put it together using pattern books. And then the family, the Brown family, as I said, Margaretta, and Mason, the eldest son, lived there after the Browns died. And so it was kept in the Brown family all the way up till 1934. The last Brown family member died then. And then it became, in a circuitous way, the property of, or managed by the Colonial Dames of America, who still manage the property. And the house next door, so we have two houses. We also have the Orlando Brown House, an 1835 Greek rival home. And so, and we're on 4 acres, and we're on the Kentucky River, so you should come visit and get a tour, and you'll learn a lot more. I just told you. So we have tours Monday through Saturday at 1:30. Yeah. Yeah.
Is there any connection that you have read about Lafayette and the Masons here in Louisville? I'm not
The Masons, like a Margaretta Mason or different Masons? Oh, the Masons Masons. Yeah. I haven't read anything about that, but that's, she asked the question about, is, were the Masons connected? He did visit some Mason halls, didn't he, when he came to Kentucky? Yeah, I'm not sure. Not in Frankfort, but I think he might have visited in Lexington, a Mason's hall. But yeah, I that didn't come up in what I was researching. But yeah, go ahead.
You said that you speculated that Lafayette did not know him.
That he didn't know him? Yeah. I think he, you know, I think he, I mean, he might have known him. I don't know. But it's just, she doesn't mention him. So I'm just looking at the documents and looking at the letter really closely. And it, we just, I haven't seen any evidence of it. But I think it was all about the brother, you know, James Brown, and that's why, you know, he met a Brown family member, and he just, he really was indebted to their family. So, any other questions? Yeah?
Yeah, the Middletown City Hall, which was an inn in those days, they have a sign that says that the Lafayette stayed there when he was en route from Louisville to
West. Oh, yes. Is that Middletown?
Yeah, in Middletown. It's called the Weatherby House, but mm-hmm. it was an inn in one. But they have, as I recall, the sign says that there's a myth that Lafayette lost a diamond ring or jewel ring of some kind.
Uh-huh.
And for many years, people who stayed there would dig around the property.
Well, see, I think that might be, yeah, so there's a myth. Yeah, that, yeah, I think there's a lot of those. I mean, I just ran into someone in Frankfurt the other day, and I told him I was doing this talk, and they had lots of little, oh, he went here and there and the other place. And I was like, no, I don't think he did. But, yeah, and it's, yeah, so I think it's just for fun stories. So I don't know about that. But he did stop there, I think you're right, in Middletown. Yes?
I grew up in Frankfurt.
Oh,
yeah.
Uh-huh.
It was really fun because we used to play, you know, yeah. in the backyard. And
the gray lady.
Yeah. There was also, I mean, when I was a kid, sometimes we'd make homemade ice cream.
Oh.
And
uh-huh.
the whole ice house was right
there. Yes.
That
yes.
I mean, we would go to the ancient ice house.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
But what I was going to say was I'm a big fan of Margaret Weiss Brown.
Uh huh.
Who's a descendant who stayed there. But then I was thinking, Margaret? I mean, did it become a family name?
Well, actually, that's different. Margaret Weiss, she asked about Margaret Weiss Brown, which is in our family, is actually Mason. It goes through the line of that first son, Mason, and then his son, Gratz Brown, and then there was the son he had was Margaret Weiss Brown, I mean the daughter. So it goes through that, and then Margaretta was different, you know, so it was actually, she was, that I don't think it was connected, the names. I don't think that she was named after Margaretta. But yeah, she did visit the home, we know, in the 1920s. And actually, like, one of her pen names, I read this once, was Cantuck. Yeah, so it's kind of neat. So yeah, she's probably our most famous Brown. She probably is.
I knew she was Golden McDonald somehow.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah.
I didn't know she had a...
Yeah.
So do you know what she published under that name?
I don't. That's a good question. Yeah, I don't right off the top of my head remember. But yeah, she's a really interesting person. Yeah.
And And I've read that the reason she had to write under different names was because her publishers would only publish so many titles by one author in a year.
Hmm.
And she was so, you know, she's supposed to, I think she wrote over 100 books.
Yeah.
So she had to have various names to get.
Yeah, maybe so. I mean, she was, you know, she the Goodnight Moon came out in 37. I think it was 1937, I think, and so I think, you know, I mean, she's still really popular, but I mean, she kind of came up in, you know, maybe a more conservative time, so for a woman writer, yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah, they did. He asked about Washington and Lafayette if they communicated a lot. Yes, lots of letters. I know when he came back to, I mean, on this, well, Washington, of course, was dead at the time he came on this 1825, but on the 1784, I think he spent a pretty good deal of time at Mount Vernon. So, yeah, they were really close friends. Yeah?
I had the pleasure of visiting the group hall a few weeks ago. It's really lovely.
Oh, great.
The Joe Center, this is the tour, talked a lot about John Brown's relationship with Thomas Jefferson.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so she's asking about Thomas Jefferson and John Brown's relationship. Yeah, he studied law with him, and so after, I didn't talk about that, but after the William & Mary stint, he studied law with Jefferson and lived in Charlottesville area. They had a friendship, and they were both, you know, the same political, you know, they were Democratic Republicans. And he did write a letter. It was after Liberty Hall was already, you know, the plans were already done, but to say, to do a house kind of like what Monticello's looks like, if anybody's seen that. Thomas Jefferson didn't like the big hall. You're right about that front room, which we have at Liberty Hall. But, he did do that, and they did have a lot of correspondence together. So, but yeah. But he never visited. Yeah.
On one of your slides, it showed Lafayette in Kentucky.
Uh-huh.
And down the Ohio River, I saw a star, but it didn't explain. And I've heard of Lafayette Springs. Was he a steamboat wreck and lost his carriage and gold? Is that part of his story?
I don't know. He went to Cincinnati, I think, after Lexington. Is that on the map? No. You're talking about downriver?
West. Yeah.
Down west?
Lafayette.
Yeah, Carol or Hannah might know.
That's
why it was probably late and that invitation was changed. Yeah, I think I did read something about that. There was like some kind of delay. That was the delay, the weather. But I didn't look into that too much. But yeah, so you're right. Any other questions? Yeah?
You talked about the Frenchman and you showed the young Frenchman now drew the map. And we had a young Frenchman, a young man. Was your guy young who came here a year or two ago and he was following Lafayette's friend?
Yeah, he seems to be in his 20s or 30s. Yeah. Julian Isher, yeah. Mm-hmm. Did he come to Locust Grove? Did Julian come here?
Yes,
I did. He's young. He's a young guy. Yeah, that's about the time he came to see us in Liberty Hall. Yeah, his website's really great, and he's doing a lot to figure out exactly where he went. So, any other questions? Yep.
Speaking of young, how young was Lafayette when he first arrived in the United States?
So the question is, how old was Lafayette when he first came? He was 19. So really, really young. Yeah. No, you don't. No, you don't. Another question? I think that is true. Yeah. He was very much identified with America. And even, you know, when he was in Paris, he had any American come, and, you know, he was always... There's a book, I'm not sure when it came out, it's called The Marquis Lafayette Reconsidered. This book is really... It really talks about how much he really thought of himself almost as an American. I mean, he was, you know, he it's surprising he didn't come back here, I think. Yeah, so. But he did have the chance. Thomas Jefferson actually invited him. And after the Louisiana Purchase, he gave him the opportunity to have land in Louisiana, but he turned it down. I think that's, yeah, he probably sold that land, I think. Yeah. Any other questions? Yeah? That's something I don't really know. Carol, do you know? What did he do in Louisville? I know there was probably a ball, because there was balls everywhere.
He was invited to Locust Grove.
Yeah.
And he had to decline at the last minute. The excuse was the wreck, the shipwreck. But Lucy Cron did get to meet him.
Mm. Okay.
And there was a ball. But
there was a ball. I think it was at Washington Hall. Does that mean anything? Yeah. Is it somewhere downtown?
Mm-hmm.
And where did Lucy
meet?
In Louisville.
Yeah.
He went to
Soldiers
Retreat.
Oh,
he went to Soldiers Retreat. Anderson and Dupree were there.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah. Thank you.
Can you repeat that?
Yeah. She said he went to Soldiers Retreat and where else, Gwen?
Oh, in Washington Hall.
And Washington Hall for the ball.
Yeah.
Yeah. Downtown? Yeah. There you go. All right, well, thanks so much, everybody, for coming.